everybody. How are you? Good. All right. Well, good. I'm glad you're here. We are in the second week of our teaching series called Game Day. We're taking a look at how a simple game called football can help unlock some important methods for us in a simple faith that we've got called Christianity. And so we are going to pick up with our scripture. We read the whole thing last week. Now we're going to begin to dissect it piece by piece. And to do that, we are going to look at Acts 17 and pick up verse 15. Here we go. Let's read that with some chutzpah. The men who escorted Paul brought him to Athens and then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you." You know, I have a small confession to make to this community. On this Sunday morning, I have a small man crush on Peyton Manning. I do. You know, it's when you're a Detroit Lions fan, the way that you do the Detroit Lions football season is you root for the Lions, plus you have to have another team, because it's usually not going to work out so well for you. So, yeah, this year it's looking pretty good so far, but I've always loved Peyton Manning. And so when we moved down from Michigan to Kentucky, the only thing that you could get where we live were Bengals games and Colts games, and the Colts games, we just sort of gravitated towards the Colts. But I love Peyton Manning. And I don't love him because I think he's a great football player. I think he's a great leader. And part of what makes him a great leader is not only that he's tough and a hard worker, but he's a student of the game. I mean, of all the players that I can think about in football, Peyton Manning is a great student of the game. He believes that he can constantly improve. And that's what I love about him. You know, he's always learning. He's one of the most seasoned quarterbacks in the whole NFL, and yet he's constantly learning, how can I do this better? He studies more film. He's the first guy there and the last guy to leave. He's always learning from his teammates, and I think that's what makes him such a great player. I want to watch this video with you here a minute. I know one of the big things that he became known for last year was this call Omaha, and let's do a little bit of study on Omaha here this morning.
15, Iverson, Apple, Eagle, 95,
Hold Allen,
Wisconsin, Gordon, Standard,
Sparrow,
check service,
check Smokey left, 26 Mike, what's right, Wisconsin, Gordon,
Josh, we welcome you in here. I mean, I don't know how many words you use, Ray. I mean, how do you guys deal with those hard counts?
Boom, I got to tell you, I love the chess match of the game, and you're going to see it first and foremost today. Peyton Manning, of course, with that Patriots defense. And let me give you a little insight to what goes on. And Ray Lewis is going to play middle linebacker, and he's had to play against Peyton Manning many times and see all the theatrics of Peyton Manning. But what will happen first, Peyton Manning will go in the huddle. He'll say, "Guys, trips right, no play, get to the line." Key, as I said, no play. There is theatrics now involved. Now Peyton Manning gets the line of scrimmage. He's looking at the defense. Reno, 57. Y over, Reno, 57. Y over, slide over. Mike, 52. Mike, 52. Alert, alert. Reno, set hot. The ball doesn't come. What are you thinking when he's saying, 52 is Mike, 52 is Mike?
That's when I'm sitting there and I'm settling my defense down. Because when Peyton comes out and does all that, it's one thing that I've studied over Peyton for many years. Every word that Peyton says out of his mouth, sometimes it means something, sometimes it doesn't mean something. It doesn't mean nothing. And when you get to understand that, when you start to pay attention to the play clock, when you're watching the play clock with Peyton Manning, he's not going to do anything before 15 seconds on that play clock. So when he comes out and he starts doing all this, 52 is Mike, he wants to see what you're in. He's reading the mail, right? He wants to see if a safety is going to rotate down. He wants to see if a linebacker is going to take a step back. He's going to see if a linebacker is going to take a step up, put his hands on the knees. Most linebackers, when they're blitzing, they put their hands on their knees and they start to lean a little bit. If he can get that pre-snap before he actually calls his play, then he can go back in and change it.
Right on. It's all about the theatrics. Peyton Manning trying to get the defense to tip their coverage. They tell. Then he will do this. Now that he knows what the coverage is, he has what they have, a code, a live word. It could be a color green. It could be the state of California. All of a sudden he gets back in that position, and once he uses that code word, California, California, now his offense is on the alert. The next words that he say, those are the play. 679 arrow, 679 arrow. Now, that's the real play.
And out of that play, the next sound you hear that comes out, whatever it is, the ball is snapped.
Omaha, set up.
The ball is snapped.
Omaha, right set up. There.
And that's when you get into your defensive play. And that's where most of the time you can confuse them, because if you can hold it long enough, if you can be patient long enough to play that chess match with him and he calls the wrong offense against your defense, you win.
All right. Hey, and get this. All that stuff Ray just said, the next step, you know what he'll do? Freeze it all. He'll freeze it all and start all over again. Man, what a chess match.
Man, what a chess match. Now, and you might be thinking, why are we watching ESPN SportsCenter in the middle of church? But I think there's something powerful that you can learn from this. And it's not just a football principle, it's very much a spiritual kind of principle. You know, in the San Diego game last year in the NFL playoffs, Peyton Manning audibled 44 times this call, Omaha, in the middle of the game. And what I loved about what Ray Lewis said is he says, sometimes when he says it, it means something. Sometimes it doesn't mean anything. Well, that's incredibly profound, Ray. I appreciate that. But the principle, I think, really is about this. Peyton Manning knew the playbook so well that he could read defenses. And once he read the defense, the thing that he would do next is call the right play. And how often in our walk as Christian people would it help to read people's defenses to faith, so we can have the right kind of conversation with folks? Preparation is all about preparing for performance, right? And everything that we do, from whether we talk about worship, our Bible study time, prayer, small groups, serving, everything that we do, we talk about one-to-one-to-one-to-one-to-one here at Revolution. An hour for worship, hour for a group, hour to serve, an hour of your paycheck to give, and one person to invite. All of those things prepare you for conversations that you're going to have every day in your life with people who have questions about Christianity, questions about God, questions about life. And how prepared you are, how well you know the playbook, gives you opportunity to speak truth and to speak life into people's lives. Let me ask you this question. What do these people have in common? They're all younger, but what I'd like to say is they're all professionals, but they all lack perhaps a bit of experience. How many of you would pick a surgeon without gray hair? Depends, right? Depends. Or what about a mechanic who can't yet shave?
Yeah, I don't know.
Depends on what kind of car you got, I guess, right? Yeah, I mean, there's something powerful about experience. Youth is great because you can't bottle the amount of passion and energy and new techniques that can be applied. But there's something also that's very powerful about experience. You know, the priest, the last character on the right in this graphic, that's one of the characters in the movie Gran Torino. Have you all ever seen Gran Torino? probably not exactly the most racially sensitive of movies, so I want to give you that caveat. But I think what's interesting is the character, this character buried the main character, who's played by Clint Eastwood, and his name is Walt Kowalski in the film, buried his wife. And so after he buries his wife, the priest goes to his home and wants to have a conversation with Walt Kowalski. And he is not interested at all in talking about God, Jesus, church, or any of it. In fact, he says to the priest, "You know nothing about life or death because you're an overeducated 27-year-old kid who holds the hand of superstitious women and promises them eternity." Wow. Warm fuzzies, right? But I think what Walt knows is the same thing that Peyton Manning knows. It takes about 10,000 hours to be a master at your craft. It takes repetition. It takes practice. It takes knowing the playbook, living the playbook, and putting that playbook into action. And Manning's preparation is so much similar to our preparation as Christians. The more that we prepare, the greater the opportunity that we have to speak truth into people's lives. And so we've been looking at our vision during this teaching series, this vision of joining Jesus and transforming people's lives through the revolution that Jesus brings. And we do this through teaching and serving. We've been talking about revealing and resurrecting and releasing and all of these different purposes. Today, I really want to focus on revealing. How do we reveal God in the places that we go? How do we reveal God's truth and God's love in the people that we meet, ordinary people in ordinary circumstances every day? And so much of it is done exactly through what we watched about just a few minutes ago on ESPN. It requires reading people, reading their defenses. I mean, Peyton Manning doesn't walk into a huddle these days with all kinds of plays saying, "Listen, we're going to run this play no matter what." The first thing that he does is he steps to the line, he reads the defense, he figures out what to call, and then he calls the play. And I think for Christians, for a while, we're going to talk about this today, we've had one method of having spiritual conversations or of inviting or of sharing our faith with somebody. And what's really required is that we listen and learn and get to know folks before we can respond appropriately. Let me invite the band to come on back up. Because I think at the end of the day, whether you're talking about, you know, pastors or dedicated Christians or just anybody off the street, everybody has defenses when it comes to talking about faith, don't they? I mean, everybody has a "I can't go there" area. Or maybe if not a "I can't go there" area, that's tough for me to talk about. And so often it has to do with things that have happened to us, experiences that we've had, questions or doubts that we've got about our own faith. And the more that we can understand those, the more that we recognize them in other folks, the more that we recognize them in ourselves, it gives us an opportunity to transform lives. So we're going to be looking at revealing today, and we're going to do it through this metaphor of Omaha. Let's continue to worship. You know, I want to take you back to Mars Hill. And we talked about Mars Hill last week in our teaching series that as we kicked it off. And I said that Mars Hill was sort of like the intellectual capital of the ancient world. In ancient Greece, anybody who was anybody, Socrates, Plato, all of these guys would hang out on Mars Hill, and they would constantly debate the nature of truth and reality as it really is. So they're talking about life. They're talking about the big picture. How can we know what we know, and how can we know that we know and we know it? I mean, really, really wild, heady kind of stuff. And so this is Paul's context, right? This is Paul rolls up on Mars Hill. And as I think about Mars Hill and our culture today, I think they're very, very similar. Because on Mars Hill, what people are trying to debate is the definition of what truth really is. And as I look at Facebook and Twitter and whether you read Drudge or Huffington Post, this is what people are debating, right? I've tried to provide all sides of the spectrum, right? Okay, good. People are they're fighting for the definitions. Have you noticed that? A few years ago when the presidential election was on, our community, I think, struggled mightily because people would post that they liked this about a certain candidate or, you know, down these people for saying that. And somebody who who believed or thought something on the other side of the spectrum would take great offense, and they would come back. And we had these people who were just jabbing at one another on Facebook. And I want to say, come on. Mars Hill and our culture today, they're not 2,000 years removed. They're about 2 seconds removed. Very, very similar kinds of culture. All of these sources of information are fighting to define what the truth really is. And it was the very same thing on Mars Hill. I think the interesting thing about Mars Hill is this, too. The very first verse that we read of our scripture this morning leads us to understand that Paul was on Mars Hill. It was sort of like a rest stop. He was waiting for Silas and Timothy, and they were going to head on to the place that they thought they were supposed to be going. How many of you have stopped for a vacation? You pull off on the side of a highway, you find this little sleepy town, and there's a gas station, and you realize, oh, there's a bunch more. Let's check it out for a little bit. I see some smiles. So clearly some of you have done this. And this is exactly what happened for Paul. Paul didn't think that the mission was Mars Hill. Paul thought that the mission was wherever he was headed next. Hey, we got to get to Ephesus. Hey, we got to get to Corinth. I'm not interested in Mars Hill. And yet Mars Hill was the very place that God was leading him to. And there on Mars Hill, people are fighting to define the truth. What's the truth? So they have these great debates on this big rock, because that's what you do. The rock's just changed for us, right? Now it all happens in a cloud instead of a rock. And people always say, where is the cloud? Have you ever noticed that? Like, where? Anyway. Yeah. So the rock's just changed. That's all. Now, the cool thing about Paul is if you were to look throughout the book of Acts, you will find that in every town that Paul goes to, he's going to go to two places. He's going to go to the marketplaces and he's going to go to the synagogues. Why does he do that? Well, quite simply, he goes to those places because in those places, people are going to tell him what the culture believes, what the culture values, what the culture desires, what the culture's vision for life is all about. And so Paul goes to the marketplaces and the synagogues, and in those places, he's doing something quite simple. He's watching, he's listening, he's learning, and then he prepares to call Omaha. He's reading the defense, isn't he? Before he ever preaches any kind of gospel, Paul consistently watches, listens, and learns about the culture, and then the presentation of the gospel is always shaped to what the culture believes, values, thinks, etc. I think that's profound. Because the scriptures say that Paul was deeply distressed. When he watched, when he listened, when he learned about the culture, he became deeply distressed. There was something about the people that broke his heart. It was the people who were so dedicated to searching for truth, and yet the truth that was there before them, they were missing it. And here he was in this gas station stop on his ministry, and there he has an opportunity to reach people. Here's the question, folks. How many, quote, chance encounters do you have every day where you can speak words of truth, of hope, and of God's love into people's lives? I mean, it's so interesting. If I had one question over the last 5 years of being a pastor, it's always this. I want to know God's plan for me. As if it's like this sort of ethereal, you've got to go on a trip to a mountaintop or something to find it kind of thing, right? So I want to know exactly what he wants me to do. Yeah, well, you can ask him. That's a big one. But so often, what's God's plan for you? We talked about it last week, great commandment. Love God with everything you are. Love people in the same way. And great commission to go and make disciples. And how often do we miss fulfilling the great commandment, the great commission, in the ordinary spaces of our lives? Because those people look like an inconvenience. I can't serve you. I can't talk to you because I'm on my way to this really big thing that God has for me. And God's going, right, SMH, you're killing me here. Like, that is the big thing. SMH just smacked my head. Sorry about that. See, that's my way of trying to, like, get into that younger part, right? I'm gaining on experience and also in gray hair, but I'm trying to get younger at the same time. Yeah, it didn't work. And where the church, folks, has missed the boat is for the past 30 to 50 years, when we talk about faith, it's often gone like this. I knock on somebody's door, and I am going to go one of two roads. I'm going to go with the, if you died tonight, where would you go road? Or I'm going to go with the, it starts with you're a sinner. And, you know, because you're a sinner, you deserve eternal punishment, you know, headed to hell in a gas truck, all of those kinds of things. But is that even biblical? Because what I see in the book of Acts is this. I see Paul going, listening, learning, watching, and then calling Omaha. Shouldn't we learn about somebody first before then spewing this message forth? Yeah. Yeah. Well, why? Well, because their questions may not be the same as other people's questions. And the greatest way to meet people is probably not with the question, if you died tonight, where would you go? There was a time where that worked great. But that's not our culture today. One of the first churches that Mandy and I served, there was a guy who I was inviting all the time, right? Hey, we'd love to have you up at church. You're such a great guy. You would fit in great with these folks. And, you know, I'd love to get you in a group. Or, hey, we've got this event, and it would be awesome if you could come to it. And, you know, I think we have a lot to learn from you, and maybe we can teach you a thing or two along. I mean, I'm trying all of these different angles. And I notice along the way, in the midst of all of my spewing, that he says words like good Lord and good book. Now, this is sort of a country thing, right? Good Lord, good book, good work, this sort of thing. So I know that as I begin to listen to him, I recognize there's a God belief kind of thing in his life. I'm not really sure why he doesn't want to do church, but whatever. So I keep inviting. And then finally one day, God really gets a hold on me and he says, Ebel, why don't you listen to the guy for 5 minutes before you invite him? Okay. And so I said to him, I said, hey, here's the deal. You know, I notice you use the good Lord, good book kind of language. So you believe in God, right? Yep. Okay, well, what's up with the no church thing? I mean, what's going on with that? And he said, oh, well, here's the deal. 15 years ago, I got a divorce. And when I got a divorce, the people excommunicated me from the church. Excommunicated literally meaning you're kicked out, done, we want nothing to do with you. And he said, you know, I watched all of my friends turn their back on me because I was kicked out of the church and I felt like I was the second, third, fourth class kind of citizen. And I said, wow. I said, well, why didn't you go to another church? And he said, well, did you not just hear me? The church excommunicated me. I said, well, our church didn't excommunicate you. He said, huh. I said, well, and beyond that, where in the Bible do you ever find that you're supposed to get excommunicated for a divorce? Tell me about the divorce circumstances. And then the floodgates opened, right? And he said, well, you know, my spouse had multiple affairs, and there were all kinds of painful things that happened. And it wasn't, you know, like we were working through the other stuff. But then beyond that, she would just say some of the nastiest things to me. She was always tearing me down, and her family hated me, all of this kind of stuff. I mean, it just went on and on. It was an unhealable kind of relationship. Look, God can heal all kinds of relationships and all kinds of circumstances. This was not a circumstance that was ever going to get healed, at least on this side of eternity. And I said, well, you know, let's look at some scripture for a minute, because the scriptures that I know says that, you know, in cases of adultery, divorce is very much permitted. And he said, really? Show me that. So I put it there before him. And he started reading it, and man, the tears just started coming down. I said, divorce or no divorce, whatever, why would God ever turn his back on you? you know, after I shut up for 5 minutes and listened to the man's story, there was an opportunity to sow some truth into his life. How much is the case for each one of us? 9 times out of 10, the reason that people don't want to have anything to do with God, anything to do with church, anything to do with Jesus, has nothing to do with the core beliefs of Christianity. It has to do with their experience of Christianity. It's the language like, you know, God will never give you more than you can handle. Had enough, right? Or whenever God closes a door, he opens a window. That's a pretty lousy window I'm getting here. I mean, it's these kinds of one-liners and things that they've been taught, things that they've heard, that keeps people from God and keeps people from the church. And until you know that, until you watch, listen, and learn, until you love on folks, you don't get an opportunity to call Omaha. You know, Paul read the defense brilliantly. When he walks into Mars Hill, he doesn't say, "Listen, all of you pagan people who've had it wrong for all of these years." That's not his open one-liner. It's quite simply, "I can see in every way that you are very religious." You know what I hear him saying? "You guys are trying to know and see and understand the truth. You've even got this one statue that says to an unknown God." I mean, you guys have covered all the bases so far to say that, hey, in case we've missed one, here he is. We want to make sure that God has a place too. Now let me tell you about this one God that you don't know. Yes. And then he begins to open up the truth to him. He didn't come to him with a prepackaged presentation. He came to them at their level, where they were at. And the playbook, as we talk about revealing, is very much just about that. How do we help people seek and feel and find God at work in their lives? And the misnomer that the church often gets is this, that God in some way is absent from people's lives. No, God is working in everybody's lives. Some people just don't yet see it. And so you get the opportunity to help people see God at work in their lives. What do people often say? "Well, you know, God, he didn't want anything to do with me. I've got buddies who I'm constantly, you know, trying to listen, learn, love on, invite." And they say, "If I came into your church, I would spontaneously combust into flames." And I said, "As far as I know, that's never happened in the history of Christianity, the church, or anything else in between. Tell me why you feel that way." And they begin to say that, and then I'll begin to ask them questions like, "Well, when your kid was born, tell me, what did that feel like? It was the most amazing experience ever." And you know, okay, why? "Because it's like there's something bigger than me now." Huh, well, doesn't that sound like perhaps God might be at work? Or, you know, I could have, in my life, I saw this crossroads. I could have gone one way or I could have gone the other way. And thankfully, I chose the right path. You chose the right path? And then all of a sudden, there's this aha moment for him, right? Oh, man. Like, I did that and I didn't even know that I did that. So that was God? I don't even have to answer it for him then. I'll just go, "I don't know. I guess you got to figure it out." And then they say, "Ebel, that's terrible. You can't do that to me." And I said, "Well, you know, let's go get Starbucks or whatever." So here's the deal. You know, you have an opportunity every day in places that look like a rest stop or a gas station to sow truth into people's lives. And if you listen, learn, and love on them, you're going to help them seek, feel, and find God's presence in their own lives. And you can do this in a number of different ways. It might be a come and see approach. "Hey, I know you've got questions about. Here's a study. Here's some teaching. Let's investigate it." You might ask them, "Tell me about your life. What's going on in it? Tell me about your own journey." You might be direct. I mean, some people you've known for a while, and maybe they've got destructive behavior in their life. Sometimes the most grace-filled thing you can do is say, "Brother, sister, you keep making these decisions, and it pains me. How are these decisions you're making working for you?" And that can open up conversation. But revealing is about inviting other people to see that God is already at work in their lives. You're just simply coming alongside them and you're asking them to recognize God's presence, God's power at work in their lives, and to simply yield to it. When you came in this morning, you got a Peyton Manning Omaha list. There's 30 lines on it. An exercise that we do every now and then here at Revolution is to think about the people in your life. Who are 30 people in your life that you can pray for, love on, listen to, learn from, and invite? Whether to be part of Sunday morning worship, to see God's presence and work in their lives. Let's take a moment, we'll reflect on that.
All the vapor of it all, it's a chasing of the wind, the powers of the earth, so pale and thin. We will set our hearts on you the hearts of men. We can feel it from within, the beauty of it all, the mystery, the swelling of a voice, a rising sea.
How many of you could come up with at least 10? How many of you are like, this is a dangerous exercise, I don't want to play? Yep. You know, I think when it comes to this business of the Great Commandment, the Great Commission, when it comes to following God's playbook, the assumption is that it's somebody else's joy or somebody else's responsibility. And from the scriptures that I read, it doesn't say that this is a pastor's responsibility or it's the missionary's responsibility. It says that it's everybody who follows Christ's responsibility. And I don't want you to look at it as a responsibility because that almost has like a negative connotation, right? That's sort of a eat your lima beans or clean your room kind of thing. It's a joy. I mean, have you ever walked with somebody as their life was changed? It's the greatest thing in the world. I mean, to watch someone's life change before your very eyes is the greatest privilege that God will ever give you. To watch them be awakened to God's presence, to God's power working in their lives. Greatest privilege in the world. When Paul called this Omaha on Mars Hill, it was on the way to what he thought was a more important mission. And yet, from the experiences that he had, Paul came to know better. He came to know it was still his responsibility, no matter where he went, to listen and watch and learn and love on the people and then call the audible. And the revelation that he shared with the Athenians was a powerful one because their worldview, their story was that they were sprung up from the dust of the earth, from the soils of Attica. Kind of sounds like another scripture passage that we know from Genesis chapter 2, that people were created in the dust of the earth, that God formed them and shaped them according to his image, and that God gave them a greater purpose to care for and to steward all of creation. And so what Paul begins to share with them, and we're going to see this over the next couple weeks in the book of Acts, is that they shouldn't be beholden to some dirt. They're beholden to God. And at the end of their lives, they're not going to lie in that same dust of the earth. They're going to be raised from the dust of the earth to new life. One story ends in death, the other story ends in life. And for the Athenian philosophers on Mars Hill who were always debating the truth and the source of life, that he's saying this, he's saying, listen, guys, your whole lives you've been shaping and molding from the dust of the earth all of these idols that don't live or move or breathe. And instead, what I want you to hear is this, that God brings the dust of the earth to life and creates you and me. And when we die, he raises us to new life and life everlasting. Who do you trust? Like a great quarterback, I think Paul read the defenses of the people and he called Omaha. And the amazing thing about the game day on Mars Hill is this. It produced a powerful disciple or follower of Jesus called Dionysius the Areopagite. Say that five times fast. Dionysius, what a testimony, what a story. He became a follower of Jesus. Later, he became a bishop of the early church, and he went to a region called Gaul. Gaul would be what's now modern-day France. And the interesting thing is, the Greeks believed, because they were raised from the dust or the soils of Attica, that they were intellectually superior to all the barbarians in the rest of the world. So Dionysius is so captivated by this message that Paul shares that he goes to the barbarians on the other end of the world and he begins to share with them the good news about Jesus. And thousands are converted, which converted more thousands of people, and the world was transformed. All because Paul, at a stop along the way, was faithful to the playbook, and he called the audible at the same time. This week, you are going to be stopped at places that feel like they're along the way, and I'm going to ask you, how well prepared are you? Are you ready to share a reason for the hope within you? Yes. Are you ready to listen and learn and watch and love on and invite? Because that's the joy that God gives us as his people. Let's pray.